Welcome to the Emmy Louie Show. I am your host, Emmy Louie, and today we have an interview with the New Urban Guild. And New Urban Guild acts as an agent for architects who perform a number of services for developers and builders in the interest of building great places, and that's what it says on the website. Today's guest is Steve Muzon, and he is from the New Urban Guild. I'd love to talk to him about what he does with that organization. So welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on the show. Thank you for donating your time and just educating people, because education is so important, and that's why I'm doing this radio show. I know that when I talk to architects and even myself, and a lot of times we talk about, we want to do certain things, but our clients don't know that that's even available. And so that's why I'm also doing this too, because it also is putting it out there as far as what's available and that these services are available or this is available. Because a lot of times when people, they don't know if they want something, if they don't know it exists. So they got to know that it's out there.
Exactly.
And so Steve, so tell me a little about what you do as far as traditional architecture. I know that's one of the first things that's mentioned, and it's kind of that whole term is littered through your entire website. So tell me, what is traditional architecture?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because that really is the T word is something that really stirs up a lot of emotion amongst architects all over the country, actually, and around the world too, for that matter. And basically, what it amounts to, the way it's interpreted today amongst a lot of the architectural community, is that it's some kind of a historical pastiche that gets tacked onto a building, an otherwise modern building. And actually, nothing could be further from the truth. What a tradition really is, it's something that starts out as a great idea by one person. And that person says, hey, I have a better idea about how to build whatever it is, you know, another way to do an eave or a sunny garden spot or a porch column or whatever the case might be. So they build it, and then they build it again in their own work. And so it becomes what we call a personal pattern. Well, if enough people around them in the town, or city or village, whatever it is that they're in, sees the pattern and says, hey, I've got to have that on my house or my shop or my town, whatever it is. And then they build it. Then the thing becomes a local pattern. Now, at the point that it goes from being a personal pattern to being a local pattern, at that point, it can be said to have taken on a life of its own, because even if the original creator dies, then the pattern may persist for decades or centuries or even millennia in some cases after the original creator is dead and forgotten even. And then after a while, if it's built in a particular, in that particular town for a while, and then the people in the whole region, come to know about it, and they say, you know, we really love this. This, we want to adopt this into our family of regional traditions. I mean, they don't say it consciously that way, but that's what happens. And so, therefore, by definition, that which is traditional is that which is most worthy of love. And so it has nothing to do with what's in a history book or anything like that. It's simply that which is most worthy of being loved as of now. Now, what happens is the old traditional stuff, those were traditions that were once alive in a particular region. And they remained alive because people love them. And of course, people look back now, and that's the closest we can come in many cases, because there are no living traditions hardly anywhere in the United States of how to build in a particular place. And so that's why people get confused over thinking that it means repeating history. But actually, it does not. It actually is what can be loved today.
I was thinking about a very specific example, and I don't know if you need to necessarily answer it, but I was just thinking about what you were saying. And one of the, in where I am, it's a very much suburban, and there's a development, and it looks like a Charleston setting, the development, and you've got all these kind of one house per acre kind of development, and then in the middle of this kind of suburban development, there's this Charleston kind of setting where the houses are packed in. And then I noticed there's one thing missing, though. There was one thing missing, and it was people that were walking on the sidewalks. Do you have any thoughts about that? I don't know why I just thought about that, because I was thinking there are patterns, and then there's patterns within a bigger pattern, and then it's like this Russian doll, you know, this pattern in a pattern.
Exactly. Well, I don't know specifically which place it is that you're referring to.
Oh, no, I'm just talking about a very generic thing where these planned developments are in the middle of places where there's cul-de-sacs. So I really can see that pattern.
Yeah, exactly. Well, here's really what it amounts to. Right now, there's a tremendous amount of stuff. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, most people, if you said the words New Urbanism, they would say, what? What are you talking about? You know, but today people know enough about it. And as a matter of fact, with the current housing slowdown, what is happening in a lot of markets is that the New Urbanist development in a particular market is still going. They're still selling. And then everybody else is pretty much shut down. And now everybody is looking around and said, wait a minute, I've got to get me some of that, you know. And so what's starting to happen is that rather than just having the few projects that are really, really top-notch and that really get everything right, when everybody says, I've got to have some of that, then you're starting to get some developers that are, you know, slapping on a few lampposts and putting some sidewalks in. They'll have an alley or two, and they'll say, this is the New Urbanism, when in reality it's just a hybrid project at best. And one of the things that we do that really is central to what we do, and that is something that we call pedestrian enticement. And that is, what can you do to actually entice people to come out of one door and walk somewhere and then go in another door? Now, the problem is, if it's nothing but a glorified subdivision, then, you know, where are they going to go to? I mean, they basically will go out and walk around a while and then come back in, and that's okay. That's recreational pedestrians, but the pedestrians that we really work to create are those that actually go from one place to another. Like, for example, I moved into a place about 5 years ago that actually is very much like what we're trying to design new now, and it's South Beach, Miami Beach. When I moved down here, I was driving 35,000 miles a year and came down here and now drive 8,000 miles a year. Also lost 60 pounds because of all the walking. But the big point is I walk to work. I can walk to probably 50 restaurants. I can walk to the bank. I can walk to the drugstore. I can walk to 3 grocery stores in 2 blocks. You know, you name it, whatever it is that you want, clothing stores, the, you know, office supply, Radio Shack, whatever, it's all within walking distance here. And so when you give people serious destinations like that, then you actually do create a European style walking lifestyle. Whereas if it's just a decorated subdivision with houses packed close together, that by itself really doesn't do it. And it's actually doing a disservice to people who think they're getting a traditional neighborhood when really all they're doing is getting a compact subdivision.
Steve, that's a really good point, because maybe I'm just too sensitive about all these things, because when it comes to walking in our biology, our human biology, we are meant to walk. And I know that seems like, do I have to prove that? Well, you know, you just see it. We just need to walk. I mean, it's just a human observation. And what I have noticed is that, let me just use a very specific example. My neighbor, whenever I see him walk, he walks with his dog.
Okay.
And I have never seen him walk with his dog. Now, for me, I don't have a dog, and I walk.
Sure.
And in a subdivision, a suburban subdivision, it's almost like it's unusual just to walk and not go anywhere, just to walk in a circle.
Right.
And so I almost feel like, and even when my father was visiting, he would feel weird just to walk in a circle and not necessarily walk to get something. And we are kind of talking about this. We're talking about meaningful walking. And it seems almost like if I took that dog away from my neighbor, would he actually walk? Maybe he would feel very uncomfortable walking because he's not doing something. He's not walking the dog.
Right.
And I thought that phenomenon, it's just my own observation. It's not like I'm doing the scientific study necessarily, but I'm looking at people and like, would certain people, if they were given the chance just to walk idly, would that seem too idle? It's like they're not meaningful walking. Do you have any comments about that?
Well, yeah, the thing to the meaningful walking is, like I was saying a moment ago, if you do entice people out where they actually can go somewhere to a task that they have to do, that's one thing. But the other thing about this pedestrian enticement thing that I mentioned earlier, and that is if you make a streetscape that is good enough, then people will come out and walk just simply for the pure pleasure of walking without having to have a task to do, or walk the dog or whatever the case may be, because it's simply, such a big pleasure. For example, I was in, Rome several years ago, on one of the trips there, and we were out to dinner one night, and, on the way back home from dinner, it was, I don't know how far it was, it's a good little ways, and it started raining, and we took a wrong turn, and we were out walking in the rain, through the streets of Rome, it was close to an hour that evening, but the funny thing was, because the streets were so delightful, it's almost like it didn't really matter. It was okay. Whereas if you try that in Orlando, or Atlanta or something like that, actually I say that Atlanta has some good streets, but if the streets are not, I'll put it this way, the more enticing the streets are, then the more of the walking just for the pleasure of it that actually can happen. But, you know, here's the thing. If you think about it, if you go to one of these, power centers, you know, where it might have a CompUSA and a Old Navy and this kind of thing, you know, the big box stores, not as big as the Walmart, you know, but that kind of store. And maybe you have two or three stops to make there. Think about it for a moment. Almost everyone I know, including myself, if I go to one of those stores and then have to go to another one a couple stores down, we almost always, all of us, go get in the car and drive through the parking lot to park in front of the other store, because the walk from one big box to the next is such a bad pedestrian experience that we can't even bear to walk, you know, 100 yards. I mean, it is so terribly bad. And so, but we now know the things that both on primarily residential streets and on primarily commercial streets, we know the things that cause what we call pedestrian propulsion. You know, once you entice them out, what propels them along to make them want to walk a longer distance than they otherwise would. You know, it's things as simple as on a street with storefronts, what is the sill height of the storefront windows? You know, what we found is if it gets anything above about 29 inches, and the glass starts to feeling shut down, then people don't want to walk there as much as if there's a big show window that they can see a lot of stuff in. Or if you get below about 69% glass at eye level as you walk along the street, on a commercial street, then people also want to walk there less. We also know, for example, that if in just one block, if you take the building and scoot it back and put the parking lot between the building and the sidewalk, that absolutely kills pedestrianism. People will not walk through that block. Even if they can look beyond the block and see enticing stuff further down, they will literally turn around and go back rather than having to walk through that block, where they're between the road, and the parking lot. And so, you know, those things we now know. This is more of a science now. 15, 20 years ago, it was more of an art. You know, we were kind of just guessing at what might work. But now we know well enough to be able to authoritatively say that people will be enticed here and they won't there. Another thing, real quickly, and that is on the primarily residential streets. And I say that because in all great towns, there's always a mix of uses. So it's not straight up residential, you know, for miles and miles, or a straight up shopfront for miles and miles normally, but there is a mix. But anyhow, the ones that are primarily, residential, what we've found, you know, people have accused the new urbanism for years of being, made up of these cute little, fake historic fences and porches. Well, let me tell you something about the fences and porches. A fence is a finely honed psychological protection device, and a porch is a finely tuned social engagement device. If those two are designed to exactly the right heights or the range of heights. You know, I mean, it doesn't have to be precisely 1 inch amount. But in terms of the relationship from the height of the porch over the sidewalk and the distance from the front of the porch to the sidewalk, then what happens is people will actually sit out on the porch and will feel comfortable, and they will actually start unplanned conversations with people they do not know. And that's how in these true traditional neighborhoods really get stuff right, and they don't just tack on the post lamps. That's how people actually get acquainted. And as hokey as it sounds, when you foster conversations, conversations lead to relationships, and relationships between people end up having us act like neighbors again, you know, as opposed to just going inside the stockade fenced backyard and firing up the grill and never seeing anybody, you know. So it actually, you know, at this point, we now know actually how to cause those things to happen. Whereas 10, 15 years ago, it was more an art form that you just kind of guessed at.
That's really good about all the things that you said, Steve. And in the bottom line, I know we're all of these things, you have it in your classes and it's available in an academic standpoint. And why we're talking here is really we're talking about social conversation, and we're talking about that in the end we are human beings and we are social animals, and that unplanned conversation is the spice of life. And so we're consciously bringing that forward and creating more situations where we can create that and to create that community. And that's what we desire in our very heart of hearts as just human beings. And that's what's our intention at this point. And
yeah.
Other than
the hardcore hermits, most everybody really has a craving for community. I mean, there's a few people that say, look, leave me alone. I'm going to go out to the backwoods and that's where I want to live, and that's fine. But most of us, given the opportunity to experience real community, you know, a real true functioning neighborhood rather than just something called that, then most everybody, that's what they choose.
Yeah. And that's just from observation. That's just from living. And yes, you can say this from a scientific standpoint. You can see where people, you know, where they want to live and the statistics. And then you look at your own observation because, yes, when we talk about what is the supreme teacher, it's your own experience and then it's education and other people's experiences. So you need to find out what is comfortable with your own self. And I wanted to go back to what you were saying about even Rome. And just thinking about the very romantic Rome and just that people are on almost on stage and they're walking and they're strutting, and it is very pleasurable just to walk. And I would like to see that much more so nowadays. I would like to see that kind of the art of just walking.
Well,
a big thing.
Like I say, we know now how to set the stage for that to happen. We couldn't authoritatively say that a few years ago, but we've been learning. And so at this point, we do know how to make that happen.
Well, congratulations. Congratulations on all that kind of work. And what I would like to see, I know this sounds kind of hokey, but I was thinking about some of the cartoons that I see. I like to see more new urbanism depictions in cartoons. And I have a daughter that's about 6 years old, 6 or 7, and a lot of cartoons I see, I might just see one lone house. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if all of these cartoons were set in a new urbanism setting? So I'm waiting for that.
Exactly.
Because it's a reflection of what we perceive in our society. And it could be the opposite. I mean, it could mimic our society as well as create the drive our society too. But
exactly.
To see it in the media, I like to see that. So anyway, we're here with Steve Muzan from the New Urban Guild, and his website is www.newurbanguild.com. So that's newurbanguild.com. And he has a lot of different services on that website and in that's listed on the website. We're going to talk more about that and we'll be back. I am Emmy Louie and we'll be back with Steve Muzan. Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie, and we are here with Steve Muzon from the New Urban Guild, and we're talking about community, and we're talking about New Urbanism and traditional architecture. And the last part you were talking about is that the porches also is a social engagement device. And I was thinking that a street is a social engagement device, and or it can be a social engagement device. And yeah, that we are coming back to pedestrian rights.
Well, you know, here's the funny thing about the street. I'm glad you mentioned that, because from the dawn of time until the automobile age, the street really was the primary social engagement place in a city. I mean, that's where you met people. You're all out, you know, you might pass someone and then have a conversation, whatever the case might be. And so that was where people got together. And then, of course, more recent times, what has happened is the street has become, in most cases, what I call an automobile sewer. Now, that's not an insult. The reason I use that term is because you have transportation engineers who are designing the street, and the only purpose they have in mind with that street is how many cars can I get from point A to point B as quickly as possible. Now, the formulas that they use to figure out how many cars will travel is actually very similar to the formulas that a mechanical engineer will use to figure out how much sewage will pass a given point of pipe. You know, at the edges you have drag, and then you get freer flow in the middle, and this kind of thing. And so that actually is not just a simple insult. It actually is a comparison to the way it's designed. But here's the problem: if you only have one purpose in mind, and that is just simply moving more cars more quickly, then all the other aspects of the street that a street once did, the jobs it once did, it simply doesn't do anymore. And so, you know, the term street appeal that they talk about in terms of real estate value, and it absolutely is true that a house has to have street appeal. But what happens is, at one point in time, it was the job of the street to have street appeal. That's why they called it that, street appeal. You know, and so the street was beautiful. The houses could actually be simpler and calmer. It didn't have to each one of them have seven gables and you know, all the bric-a-brac on the front, where they blow up, so totally blow the budget that once you get around the back where the people actually spend their time, there's no money left, and you have just a simple little aluminum gutter, and that's about the extent of it. So, but we've learned again how to actually make beautiful streets again, and so we can simplify. And so what happens on those beautiful streets, the houses themselves actually can be less expensive than the House of Seven Gables, you know, kind of the big McMansion that you see all over the place. You don't really have to do that anymore. And so there's a lot of benefits to having beautiful streets, you know, beyond just simply the physical appeal.
Well, Steve, I just learned something new today. You just brought up a point about the House of Seven Gables, and that if you have one house per acre in a suburban situation, that to have a simple house looks really weird because there's not enough interest involved.
Precisely.
That's what you're saying, right?
Exactly. As a matter
of
fact.
And that's really, that's a very eye-opening thing that that you just told me that I'm learning.
Yeah, the simple house.
Yeah, a simple house wouldn't look very good if it was sprawled out. That's why what you said, the House of Seven Gables is
exactly
needed to decorate that street front, because there's of the just the balance, because of the lack of any other interest going on.
Yeah, and the street itself is so dreadful. But yes, the simple house would look just as silly sitting on a suburban lot as the House of Seven Gables would look sitting in town somewhere.
That's a good point.
Yeah, they're both tailored to the setting, is what it amounts to.
Yes. So tell me about you were alluding to, I think you were saying form-based development. You were talking about the parking being in front of a building.
Yes.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about parking.
Yeah, it's a new thing that we call form-based coding. And basically what that amounts to is that we say, you know, basically what you have all over the country right now, except in the places that are already changing to form-based coding, But everywhere else is what you call use-based zoning. In other words, the only thing that matters really is what is the use of the building. In other words, if it's a restaurant, it gets an entirely different, it's treated totally different from an office building, from a house, from a whatever. But in form-based coding, what we say is, wait a minute now, that building may be a lot of different things over time. You know, we're building for the ages. We're not just building to be able to push the thing down and cart off to the dump in 20 or 30 years. We're actually building for the ages. So it can be things that we can't even imagine over time. So the big thing that matters the most is the building a good neighbor? How does it behave with the other buildings around it? How does it behave with the street? And then whatever use you put it in, you know, as long as it's not something noxious, you know, you don't want to have a tire recapping place right next to Main Street, you know, because that could actually blow up and kill people, I think. But, you know, a noxious use that could actually do someone physical harm, you keep those out in an industrial district. But other than that, we're saying let's pay attention to the actual form of the town that we're creating, rather than just simply, you know, counting the square feet of retail and the square feet of this and that and the other. You know, some towns like the city of Miami, which is currently in the process of enacting a form-based code, it's based on the smart code. I think they had something like 150-something, maybe it's 250, I forget, but just some huge number of uses in their current code, and so anytime you change use, you know, if you want to lease the building out to somebody else, you know, you might not be in compliance anymore, and it just really, you know, kind of gums things up that way. But by not taking care of the form, then you do get the parking lot on the front, you know, because the natural thing to think, well, then I'll have a shorter driveway and all this, not realizing that you're totally killing the pedestrian experience by doing things like that. And so the form-based code is one that instead says, no, let's make the buildings behave well, not only in what they look like themselves, but how they relate to the street. So we have very specific places that buildings need to sit according to what context they're in. Or, you know, are you on Main Street? Are you in an urban core? Are you out in the general neighborhood? Are you in the suburban neighborhoods? You know, we have different rules for if it's in the countryside, and of course there's a whole different set of rules, namely you don't build if you're actually in the wilderness. And so and briefly, what I just described was kind of the operating system of the new urbanism, which is something called the transect, which says in those six different settings of urban core, and then urban center or Main Street, and then the general urban neighborhoods and suburban zones, the suburban neighborhoods, and then the rural and the wilderness. In those six, each one has a different set of rules, as opposed to right now, you know, if you're in somebody's city limits and you go to build a place, that same curb and gutter that you're forced to put in, whether it's in a real suburban part of town or the urban core, it's exactly the same detail, which makes no sense at all. You know, that context doesn't matter. We're saying context very much, very definitely does matter. You know, there's some places that, for example, if you're living in a flat over Main Street, then you expect some noise late at night, from the night spot down the block. You expect to have, street light shining in your window. Whereas if you're out, living in a suburban neighborhood, you should expect it to be quieter at night and darker at night, less traffic and so forth. It really just simply makes us much smarter as designers and planners to be able to have a different set of rules according to different contexts, rather than just simply having to do the same thing. You know, it's the old story of if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. You know, so that's what we've been doing in the suburbanization of America since World War II. There's only one setting, and it's the suburban setting. And so that's why there's this total rolling blandness and sameness, that will occur on mile after mile after mile, of towns all across the country. You know, you don't know if you're in, Denver or Des Moines or Dallas for that matter. I mean, it just is all the same. And so, the transect lets us be smarter than that.
I wanted to just add on to what you said. There was an example, maybe have more thoughts about that. While you were saying all this stuff, I was just thinking about when I, let me use the example, when I go to a suburban movie theater, and then the movie theater is by itself, it's standalone, and then there's a restaurant, another strip mall that's kind of a little away. And so after the theater, when I want to go to that restaurant, I almost have to drive or I have to brave the cars that are leaving.
Exactly.
And so that is one example where the pedestrian, the cars are ruling. Now, the other example is I'm in this campus, this college campus, and I go to a show. And these are actually things I've experienced yesterday in the last week, so I'm just using this. I went to a campus, university campus, and I went to a ballet. And after the ballet, we could walk back to the car. And while we were walking back to the car on the sidewalks, there were all these restaurants. And so what I was thinking about this is that restaurants, and so that's a situation. The second example is more pedestrian oriented because you're able to walk from the place, the entertainment place, to the restaurant place without having to drive. And I was thinking about the restaurant in that gives it more traffic for the restaurant if there are a lot of people that were just passing by for no reason, not necessarily to go to that restaurant, but to pass by and see that the restaurant exists. And so that's the two examples that I was thinking about.
Exactly.
And so I would think that when you have somewhere that's more oriented towards pedestrians, that is actually even better for business.
Oh, precisely. No shadow of a doubt. As a matter of fact, it is a, well, I'll put it this way. When you have what we call a possum district, namely Park Once Shop Many, POSM, the possum district, actually is normally tremendously more profitable in terms of the merchants there, or substantially more, I should say, than it is a place that you have to park once, shop once. If you just simply have to go there and then and go back, you know, there is no such thing as impulse buying. That's one thing that the malls figured out years ago, is that if you could get someone to go there and you know, just to show up at the mall to say, let's go down to the mall, then they would go to other places and they would stop in on impulse and buy something they hadn't planned to buy to start with. Now, the problem with the malls, of course, is we all know that they're dying everywhere, and that's for good reason, because of the fact that in all the markets that we finally figured out how to get a real street. You know, a mall has always just has always been just a fake street. And the problem is, when it's all owned by one company and they're sitting there and doing all the leases and the management and all this, it is absolutely inescapable that the character of the mall can never develop and can never age over time and turn into what happens in a real town where everybody does things a little bit different from one shop to the next, and you have a real place. And so finally, when after all those years post-World War II of building malls, that we were ignoring the main streets and letting them run down, then finally when we started doing either revitalizing main streets and or building new developments with new main streets in them, now people are just absolutely flocking to those. As a matter of fact, if you go to the ICSC, that is the shopping center convention that they have out in Las Vegas every year, and you look around, the very few new malls that even have a booth there anymore, there's nobody at the booth. Whereas if you go to one of the ones that actually is a new urbanist town center type development, you know, where it's either in an existing town or you're building a new town and you're building a main street, I mean, the retailers are just lined up to try to get into those. So there's no shadow of a doubt that the mall is a dinosaur, that in a few years they will either be cannibalized and turned into main streets, which can happen. And actually, that's pretty fascinating, too. When you go in there and you take the buildings, you uncover the street again, and then all of a sudden set up some rules and some conditions where it can actually take on a life of its own and actually become a real place. The very first one of those that was done was a place called Mashpee Commons up in Cape Cod several years ago. It actually began, I think, about 15 years ago. And it's fascinating to see how it's turned into an actual Main Street. But the malls per se, that is the air-conditioned fake streets, are literally on their last legs, and probably in another few years you simply won't see one around because people all realize how much of a superior experience it is to go to a real Main Street as opposed to a mall.
Well, I learned my second thing I learned today, the second new thing that I, when you mentioned about the very good points, and I want to go back to what you said about that Main Street lets the building or the unit age naturally.
Right.
And does that matter if, and you also said that on the opposite, where if you have a shopping mall, it's one owner. So in Main Street, is it generally one owner? No, many owners? Or that's generally how it is? That's the default?
Yeah, Main Street typically is many owners. You typically would have, you know, each one of those buildings might be a separate owner. You know, each 30 feet or so, 25 feet, 18 feet, you know, whatever the widths are, would be different owners as you go down the street. Now, in some cases, people might come in and buy up half a block or something like that, and then rent out several of the suites to different people. But in most cases, it's actually fee simple ownership. As a matter of fact, what typically would happen is that you would have, those were actually the first of what we call the live-work buildings, where you actually live over the shop. You know, the apartments upstairs were very often where the owners live. And the live-work has become, in recent years, since we first started doing them again, over the last decade or so, they have become astoundingly profitable. As a matter of fact, some of the very first ones that were done, oh, I don't know, it was 7 or 8 years ago, something like that, at a place called the Kentlands in Gaithersburg, Maryland. When they were first, I think the number was something like, when they were first sold, I think that one of them, the small one went for $170,000 and the big one went for $300,000 or something like that. And I was telling the story of them in the presence of the fellow who was the town architect. And I said, well, you know, and recently, wow, you wouldn't believe it, the small ones are now selling for $500,000 and the big ones are selling for $800,000. And Mike turned around to me and said, Steve, you don't know the recent history, do you? And I said, no. He said, well, the small ones are now $1.2 million and the big ones are $1.8 million. So,
because of the demand, because it's so
exactly
popular.
Exactly. And here's the thing. In America today, about close to 50% of American households are actually cultivating a business at home. Now, one of the two, if it's a two-head household, one of the two may have a salary job somewhere, but the other one is starting their own business or running their own business. They're doing it all totally illegally, mind you, because, you know, in cities all over the country, you can't have a business at home in an R1 or R2 residential zone. And so until close to 50% of the units in America are live-work of some sort. Now, they don't all have to be on Main Street. You know, you can have a live-work house that's like the mansion that maybe a doctor buys and puts his practice in the front, or a real estate agent or something like that and lives in the back, or whatever the case may be. You know, so it can, there's several different types of live works, but the notion of being able to live and work literally in the same building is a really fascinating thing. And the reason that they've gotten bid out of sight price wise is just simply because it's just supply and demand. I mean, there's so few that are currently available, and so many people want to do that. And so when people realize that they can do that again, you know, have one mortgage, you know, that supports the business and the home, then they jump all over it. And so that's something that also really contributes to the pedestrianism, because here's what happens. If you have a whole street of live works, you know, it's not dedicated retail. It's not like you go down and rent out a space in the strip center, and by golly, you got to make the rent every month or you go out of business, you close the doors and they kick you out, you know. And it's not like that at all. It's more like, you know, you're making your house payment anyway, you know, and maybe in the early years, the work portion of the live work is not much more than 12 or 15 feet at the very front, right up there by the storefront. And then everything else you live in, and, you know, the rest of the downstairs might be a rec room or something like that. You know, then the kids, get up and maybe grow up and go to college or whatever. And then you expand and take over more and more of it because that wall can move back and forth. And so what happens is that live works as a result violate every law of retail survivability that you've ever known. Because of the fact that you're just making your mortgage, basically, and happen to be fostering a business at the same time. But it really allows us to do, a lot more, high quality urbanism than what you would be able to do if you were just simply renting out, space like a regular retail establishment.
Good point. And going back to what you were saying, you were saying that these are all really good points, and you probably can go more in detail in your classes and all that. Now, going back to what you said about the malls and that they're becoming a thing of the past and they will be something that will be a thing of the past in a few years. And so that is one of the biggest patterns of converting suburban areas to this new urbanism that you're talking about. Is that usually the most common thing where these mega malls are being converted to more of the traditional architecture within new urbanism? Is that correct?
Yes, and actually the mall is it's easier to turn a mall into a town center than it is to turn the subdivisions around it into neighborhoods, because the problem with subdivisions in recent years is that you know, the old subdivisions right after World War II were for the most part still fairly regular. You know, it's kind of a grid that the lots were just getting bigger, and that was about it. But, you know, in recent times, we have all this spaghetti subdivisions where it's just, you know, the roads just kind of snake around every which way, where you can't figure out, you know, you have no idea where you are, for one thing, get totally disoriented. But here's the problem. Once you get the roads in, the infrastructure in, the property lines in, unless the property value of the place, of the entire neighborhood drops so low that everybody has basically abandoned it. And this has happened in a few places already. But until that happens, it is almost impossible to remake the subdivision because of the fact that those property lines, they don't go away. I mean, people, all it takes is one or two or three owners to say, no, we don't want to sell.
So it's easier to convert a big mall.
Yeah, and so the mall itself is very easy to convert because you only have the one owner. And so you can convert that. You can actually build in the parking lot around it. You can do a lot of urbanization right there. But the subdivisions themselves around it, they are a much tougher nut to crack. You almost have to go through the whole life cycle, here's the problem. That can take, 100 years or more. Although right now we're seeing the dropping in value of a lot of the first ring suburbs, in terms of in a lot of places, they're dropping each house, between $10,000 and $20,000 a year. And so, it's going to be a spooky thing for a while, as we're going through this transition, you know, for so many years, we were abandoning the town center and then moving out to the suburbs, and then the town center, you know, the core decayed. We're actually in the process now of, since we've rediscovered how to make the town center, how to make Main Street delightful and enticing again, and people are moving back down there, then, you know, the suburbs for a while are going to have, until they reinvent themselves, or until we can reinvent them with them, you know, working with them. But until that happens, there's going to be some, a period of time, when values drop, to put it real bluntly. And that's something that the sooner we can come up with mechanisms for how to work with the existing owners, to figure out how to turn it into a real neighborhood as opposed to subdivision. You know, the sooner we can do that, and we're working on that, by the way, But the sooner we can do that, then the less property value damage will happen. And of course, you know, nobody wants to see anybody get hurt. We'd like to preserve values wherever we can. And so, but we just got to figure that out. I'll be real blunt with you. There are a lot of things that we feel like we have figured out that I've been telling you about so far this afternoon, but that's actually one that needs a lot more work.
Yeah, this reinventing the suburbs.
Exactly.
Okay, so we'll take a short break and we'll talk about how the New Urban Guild fits in with all of these things and the kind of services that they can provide for new urbanism and traditional architecture. I'm here with Steve Mouzon and I'm Emmy Louie, and we will be back. Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie, and we're talking about the work at hand for the New Urban Guild. So we were talking about reinventing the city and the suburbs. And so where does the New Urban Guild fit into all of this? Steve Mouzon.
Well, we actually do several things. We began as actually, it's kind of a funny story. There was a colleague of mine named Nathan Norris that was working with the development at the time, and he was Nathan is an enormously clever person, and he was trying to figure out a way, because that development was a little shorthanded on cash at the time, and he was saying, how should we get house plans to build without paying for them immediately? We'll pay for them when we build them, but not immediately. And so he came up with this scheme of assembling some of the best young talent in the region that maybe people didn't know of, but that they would find out about soon, and having them do the plans, and in exchange for not getting paid immediately, that they would get, he would help promote them and so forth. And he came into my office, because we've been collaborators on a lot of things, and said, "Well, Steve, what do you think?" And I said, "Well, look, if you're going to get those kind of people together and create an entity, don't just do it to get free house plans. You know, let's take this thing and pattern it after some earlier organizations. There was one, the CIAM and the IAUS were a couple of organizations that back in the 30s and 40s, and then again in the 70s up into, I think, the IAUS ended up running into the 80s. But anyhow, so that they advanced a lot of ideas. They got a lot of stuff done, to put it bluntly, without going into the long story on them. And I said, let's pattern it after something like that. We're advancing ideas. We're studying things ourselves. And we originally had this idea of doing the guild workshops. That would be just things that we would come together ourselves to report on the ways that, you know, in various climatic conditions and cultural settings and so forth, that we detailed various things, you know, doors and windows and porches and balconies and all this sort of thing. And then someone said, "Well, if you're going to be putting all this good information out there, why not open it up and let anybody come that wants to?" And so, of course, that's what we've done. And then another thing that we do is, you know, if you have, I don't care how good they are, if you have one architect come in and try to design all the buildings in a new neighborhood, it really looks like a project, because the one person, they cannot think of enough detail to actually have, you know, enough variation detail to actually have it look like it's authentic. But if you bring in a half a dozen to a dozen architects and let them actually design a lot of the buildings, then because you have so many hands involved, then you get a situation where it really does look real. Because it is real, because that's the way the old towns were built. And so that's another thing that we do, is hold these what we call design charrettes, where it would be the half dozen to the dozen that will design maybe 40, 50, 60, 80 buildings in a new neighborhood. Now, we do insist, because life is too short to not really do what you love. We do insist that we only will work in places that are a true traditional neighborhood, not just a decorated subdivision. I mean, that's a whole different market out there. that we just simply don't get into because that's not what we love. And that's just a personal preference thing, I understand. But so that's another thing. And then another thing that we've been talking about doing for years, and we finally kicked it off just this fall, it's what we call the manufactured architecture program, where we say, okay, what else can we do with all this great talent? That now we start off with a dozen guild members, and now it's roughly 60 of some of the best traditional architects in the country. And so what else can we do with all this great talent out there that really is all of the household names that most people are familiar with in terms of traditional architecture, you know? And I could go and list all that. Well, just check out the website. You'll see a bunch of familiar names. Don't have time to list them all now. But anyhow, so the manufactured architecture thing is based on the premise that manufactured products that, you know, made in a factory setting, there's nothing wrong with the factory setting. The assembly line isn't letting us down. The only problem that we have, you see, the assembly line can build to microscopic precision. The problem we have with products that are not made as well as they could is simply in the design. It's the person sitting there in the back room drawing them up. So we're saying, let us take your product, be it a, you know, a window or a handrail or a column or, you know, a shutter, you name it, whatever it is. We'll take your product. We'll hook you up with one of our guild members who knows precisely how this ought to be built. I mean, every detail. And we will let them draw the precise version for you, and we ask you to retool. If you actually will retool and build that precisely right version, then that product will get the Neurobin Guild seal of approval. It's kind of like the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. But basically what it does, now it has nothing to do with like a physical performance, like how strong is it or does it burn or not. You know, all those things are covered by the building departments and the building codes. We don't meddle with that. We just simply say, is the design right? Because really, when it comes down to it, the design being right or not makes all the difference in what someone is willing to pay for a building. You know, if everything about it is just a little bit off, and you have this vague feeling of unease over traditional architecture done wrong, then you simply you will offer tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars less for a building like that than you will one that really does get everything right. So the remaking the entire building materials industry over time is another thing on our radar screen. Another thing that we've done recently after Hurricane Katrina, my friend Andres Duany, who's the a lot of people consider him the father of the traditional town planning movement or of the urbanism movement. He and I met on the Saturday after the hurricane and basically came up with the ground rules for what are now known as Katrina cottages. And all of the original Katrina cottages, were designed by Neurobin Guild members. This massive planning effort that started in Mississippi,
was
actually the largest planning event in the history of the world. The architecture team of that was all made up of guild members and so, we're actually there's several things like that where we're trying to see a need and then fill it. That's our basic model, is to say, is there a need for something in the building of great new places or the rebuilding of great old ones? And if it's a need that's not being met, then we'll consider, you know, is it something that we can help with? But
well,
those are some
really
of the things
point.
We help with.
That's a very good point, and congratulations on all that you're doing. Because you are filling a need. And so this is Steve, I'm interviewing Steve, and he's from the New Urban Guild, and the website is newurbanguild.com. We're talking about many things, including some of these terms, such as traditional architecture, form-based development or planning. We talked about park once, shop many, and live work house, live work buildings. So those are some of the terminology, and it's exciting to talk about this with you, because it's all a matter of vision and leadership and just executing all these things, and it's very good to be interviewing you, and that you're going in the right direction, Steve.
One real quick plug, let me get in before time runs out, and
yes,
that is that, you know, there's a lot of talk today about green building, but if you build a building that may be very efficient itself, but you build it in a place that you have to drive to everything, you know, the total carbon footprint of the building can actually be huge. You can't even talk about a green, you know, sustainable building unless it's first built in a sustainable place. And that's what we've been doing, you know, for a quarter of a century now is learning how and practicing the building of these sustainable places.
It's so similar to like a filet mignon on a trash can. You might have a nice house, but
exactly,
if it's located in the wrong pattern, then it's still a filet mignon on a trash can.
Exactly, exactly. That's,
so thank
that's
you,
a great idea.
Moves on. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much. And I am Emmy Louie, and thanks for listening. And see you next week.